So our second segment now is looking at the question of Jewish women in New Testament times. We're going to look at Jewish women, then we're going to look at Greek and Roman women, and then we're going to look at how they all fit together. So this is the part about Jewish women. And by the way, I wanted to say that I misspoke once in the last segment when I referred to 1 Corinthians 5 and women prophets. What I meant to say is 1 Corinthians 11, 5. So we're looking now at Jewish women. And here are our talking points. The first one is to be aware of time differences when we're reading things about Jewish women in the Hebrew Bible, in the Old Testament. So we have regulations, for example, about what women should do and not do in Leviticus, in Deuteronomy, etc. And we have to be aware that a number of centuries have passed between the writing of those codes, those texts, and the time that we're talking about here in the New Testament period, in the first century of the Roman and the Christian era. And we're not sure. We can't assume that exactly the way something was understood in the third century BC, or even perhaps earlier than that, is the way it's understood and the way it's practiced in the first century AD. Because times change, things develop, things work differently. And also, the other problem about this is that when you have legislation, which is what you have in Leviticus, for example, we can't necessarily assume that everybody's doing it that way, that everybody's doing what this text says. This is somebody's, some group's idea of how to do it. But it's not necessarily, you can't necessarily assume then that everybody's doing it that way, see? So it's both that question of whether everybody is doing it because the text says it, but also the time lapse that's going on here. And so it's the question of reading biblical practice, what we assume is biblical practice even, into later times. Now, one of the problems of Christian interpretation of this kind of material from the Old Testament is that we read our own bias into it, and often we don't understand the spirit in which some of these texts are written. And I use the example of Talmud. Talmud is the collection of post-biblical writings in Judaism that is compiled within the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, maybe 5th centuries of the Christian era. And in some earlier scholarship, Christian scholarship, about the role of women in biblical times and in the New Testament times and in the world of Jesus, some Christian scholars have really misunderstood Talmud and have used pieces, passages from Talmud to say, this is the way Jewish women were living in the first century. Now, first of all, you have several centuries of gap sometimes. And also, there are some repressive things in about women in Talmud, and the most famous one is the opinion, the question about what would be the grounds for which a husband can divorce his wife, and this and this and this, and or if she spoils the supper. So, misunderstanding things like that. This is a Christian misunderstanding of Judaism, okay? And it's a very serious and a much bigger issue. We'll say, well, I mean, life was so hard for Jewish women, and you know, Jesus freed them from all that. Well, no, that's not it. What we have to understand is that Talmud is a collection of opinions. It is not legislation. It is the posing of a question. What should we do about this? How should we interpret this text? And a variety of different rabbis lobbing in their opinions. And all of this is collected in writing. And so for Christians to read Talmud, it's very interesting to show us how different experts and different people within Judaism were thinking. But it's not legislation, it's not law. It's not that because a rabbi says this that everybody's doing it. And indeed, the spirit of Judaism is very free about that. You observe the things that make sense to you in your worshiping community. So that again is an important point, I think. And then understanding the purity codes. What I mean by the purity codes is the legislation in both in the Bible and the opinions given in Talmud that continue to interpret it about questions of ritual purity. And if you read much in Judaism and in the Old Testament and the Leviticus even, what are the things in daily life and in not so daily life that make you incur ritual purity, that make a person unclean? Now one of them, obviously, in the Book of Tobit, you get this, is burying the dead. Now that's a very good action. You don't want to not bury the dead, but there's a period of ritual impurity after that. And so there are certain things that are defiling the bodily functions, childbirth, childbirth makes a woman in the purity code ritually unclean for a certain number of days. Isn't having a baby a good thing? Of course it is. There's no question of that. So it's very important when Christians get into these texts to understand that we're not associate ritual impurity with anything like guilt or sin, okay? It is simply a way of saying that this action puts us a little bit out of kilter with the rest of society, and so there needs to be a kind of a cooling off period. You know, in the case of the ritual impurity for a woman after childbirth, you know, it's a downtime. You know, for people who are really seriously observing this, she can't cook for the rest of her family. Somebody else has to cook. You know, so this whole idea of ritual impurity, we need to be very careful not to think of it as guilt, as somebody has done something wrong. You know, in modern American or perhaps European society, I tend to associate it with getting a traffic ticket. You know, you're driving along and you break some traffic law and you get a ticket and you have to do something to reinstate yourself. And in this case, it's paying a fee. So I find that is a kind of a similar thing. You know, it's not, oh, I feel guilty, it's darn. You know, I have to do this thing to sort of reinstate myself with the rest of society. And so that may be a helpful way of understanding this. So what do we know about Jewish women at this period? We know that they were very much part of their society. We know that they were living in cities, and I'm not talking about women in the gospel, which is another piece that we'll talk about later. But for instance, in the Pauline letters, they're living in their society like everybody else. We use this expression, the diaspora, which means diaspora really means the sowing of seed. It's in planting, in the process of planting. You know, they would sow the seed and then plow it under. So the diaspora is the sowing of the seed. But it's an expression that's used for the way in which Jewish emigrants had moved out of Judea and into all parts of the Roman Empire. We know of a Jewish community way down south in Egypt, at close to Aswan, the place called Elefantine. We know of large Jewish communities in cities like Alexandria in Egypt, in Rome, all over the what we call Asia Minor, present-day Turkey. So there are large communities of Jews. And Paul, of course, is coming from Tarsus in what is today southern Turkey. Large communities of Jews all over the Roman world. And they had been there for several centuries in most cases. And so Jewish women are, with their Jewish men, are living in cities, Greek and Roman cities. They have synagogues. They have their places of worship, which may or may not be impressive buildings. A synagogue, you know, doesn't have to be a building. It because the word synagogue means assembly. And so it can be in any kind of a building, any kind of a room. I mean, you know, it can be a rented room someplace, because the important thing is that the people gather for prayer. And I could say something, too, here about what we call proselytes. Judaism was open to converts. It was not, as far as we can determine, an aggressively missionary religion. But it certainly was open to people who wanted to join the communities. In the Acts of the Apostles, we have allusion to those who fear God. You're in a synagogue context, and it'll say all the Jews and the God-fearers, or those who fear God, those who reverence God, depends on what your translation is. And what we think that refers to is people, men and women, who are attending synagogue services, but they're not Jewish. They have not accepted the ritual for men of circumcision for both men and women. There seems to have been a baptismal ritual. So these are people who may be on their way to becoming Jews, or maybe they're just interested in it because Judaism was attractive because it was monotheistic. And it was also, this is very interesting, it was one of the very few religious groups that brought together worship and ethics. In other words, it said whom to worship, the one true God of Israel, and this is how you are to act, to behave, if you do. And in most cases, most religions in the world that they're in tell you what God to worship and how to worship. But if you want to know how to live, you have to go to philosophy. And so Judaism, because of the idea of covenant theology, God makes this covenant with the people, and the people's response is to live according to the law. So there was this integration of worship and ethics and way of life, which of course then Christianity picked up and got it from Judaism. So women are part of all of this, and they're living their lives in just a normal way.